And we're rolling. Hi, this is Mark Goldberg with the UN Affairs blog, UN Dispatch. I'm talking today with Richard Dicker of Human Rights Watch. Richard, what is your sort of official title?
I am the director of Human Rights Watch's International Justice Program.
Great. And today we are going to be talking about the International Criminal Court, specifically some of the cases before the court. I think as most viewers know, the United States is not a member of the court, but that does not mean that the court does not exist and is not sort of doing what it was sort of created to do, which is prosecute war criminals. So I'm hoping today, you know, we can get, and Richard's real expert on the court and sort of what's going on at the court. So I was hoping we might sort of have a discussion about sort of what's going on now and how the court works. And maybe a good jumping off point is news that just came out last week that one Jean-Pierre Bemba, a militia leader in the Democratic Republic of Congo, also a senator in the Congolese parliament and a former vice presidential candidate of the DRC, was arrested in his home in a suburb outside Brussels yesterday and is now awaiting extradition to The Hague. So maybe I'll turn it over to you now, Richard, to sort of explain who Jean-Pierre Bemba is and sort of what happened last week.
Certainly. Jean-Pierre Bemba is a Congolese politician and military leader. He had been a vice president in the Congo's transitional government for a number of years just prior to the presidential election in 2006, where he was the leading opponent of DRC President Joseph Kabila. He came close to defeating Joseph Kabila in that presidential election, lost in the aftermath of the election. There were incidents in Kinshasa, the capital of DRC, involving some of Jean-Pierre Bemba's forces and armed incidents with forces loyal to President Kabila. A number of people were killed in that armed encounter. And following that, Jean-Pierre Bemba left the Congo, had been living for a while in Portugal, and as you had indicated, Mark, just over the weekend was arrested at his wife's home outside Brussels in Belgium. But what he was arrested for, I think, is interesting to go into. These were alleged crimes that Bemba, according to the International Criminal Court prosecutor, was responsible for, not in the Congo, but in the neighboring country of the Central African Republic back in 2002-2003, when there was an attempted military coup there against the president. The president at that time, an individual named Patase, not being confident on support from his own Central African Republic armed forces, called in Jean-Pierre Bemba's armed group, the MLC, Mouvement pour Libération du Congo, to assist him, President Patase, in suppressing that armed uprising in Central African Republic. In the course of doing that, the ICC prosecutor alleges that Jean-Pierre Bemba was responsible for a wide number of rapes that occurred in and around the capital of the Central African Republic, torture that occurred, and acts of pillage. I believe there are six counts in the arrest warrant, counts of crimes against humanity, two on war crimes. So those are the charges with which the Belgian police arrested Jean-Pierre Bemba, and as you said, Mark, he is currently in custody near Brussels and is awaiting hearings on a possible surrender by Belgian authorities of Mr. Mbemba to the custody of the International Criminal Court in The Hague.
Interesting. So essentially, he was a Congolese was arrested for crimes committed in neighboring Central African Republic.
Yes. And let me just add, I think the significance here is that Jean-Pierre Bemba is a major figure. He is a senior leader in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And I think this arrest warrant and apprehension suggests that the International Criminal Court is raising, if you will, its sights from militia leaders of one type or another to political figures. And Human Rights Watch believes it's absolutely essential that the prosecutor of the court turn his attention not only to militia leaders as those who have been arrested for alleged crimes in Eastern Congo, but to the senior political and military figures who bear the greatest responsibility for use of rape as a weapon of war or intimidation, acts of ethnic cleansing and slaughter of helpless civilians. So it's very, very important to target senior political figures who we believe have responsibility for the horrific crimes that have occurred in both Democratic Republic of the Congo and the Central African Republic. I think in regard to Monsieur Bemba, we believe the ICC prosecutor should investigate crimes associated with Jean-Pierre Bemba's militia, the MLC, that were committed in eastern Congo in the Ituri province, where the prosecutor has charged several others to date. There were very serious crimes associated with the MLC that we think merit serious prosecutorial analysis and investigation.
So I guess what you're saying then is that this arrest of Bemba is sort of significant in the sense that it is the sort of really the first time that the prosecutor is going after a political leader and not someone who is just a militia leader in some sort of forlorn place, but actually, you know, a pretty senior political figure. And, you know, I've been reading accounts of the reaction to this arrest in the Congo, and it seems as if his party, which, you know, I guess controls a certain faction of the parliament in Congo, is none too pleased about this. And do you sort of see, are you following sort of what the reaction of this is in Kinshasa, in the capital?
Yes, we are. I just want to add that the ICC prosecutor has charged for crimes alleged to have been committed in Darfur, in Sudan. He has charged a government minister, Ahmed Haroun, for crimes, I believe some 51 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity there. But other than Ahmed Haroun, Jean-Pierre Bemba is the first senior political figure. And really, our point to the ICC prosecutor and to the international community is that to send a message to the Great Lakes region of Africa, where there have been so many horrific crimes committed against helpless and innocent civilians, it is important to target those at the top of the chain of command. And for crimes that have occurred in the Congo itself, we believe there are political leaders in Kinshasa, in Kampala in Uganda, in Kigali in Rwanda, whose records and actions need to be looked at in order to send a message that there is zero tolerance for the commission of these kinds of horrific acts against civilian populations. So Jean-Pierre Bemba's arrest is one step. It should not be the final step in bringing to justice those responsible for crimes in this sub-region of Africa.
I guess also what's interesting about this particular arrest is the fact that, you know, he was arrested. There are a lot of indictees out there. I ask you sort of the exact number. I know there are sort of some presumably under sealed indictments, as sort of Bemba was under a sealed arrest warrant. But what's interesting that, you know, Bemba was actually arrested, and I think that's probably because he was in Belgium and not in sort of the DRC. You know, right now we have, you know, we've chatted before on this program about sort of Uganda, northern Uganda, Joseph Kony. Right now he's running around in the bush away from any, you know, arresting authority. And that seems to be sort of almost like one of the biggest problems and hurdles facing the ICC is that it has no sort of police force and it has no way to arrest people. It depends on member states to do so.
Yes, I think you put your finger on what is the Achilles heel of the International Criminal Court and all of these international criminal tribunals, the Yugoslav Tribunal, the Rwanda Tribunal, the Special Court for Sierra Leone. As international courts, they have no arrest capacity themselves. They are totally reliant on states and international organizations like the United Nations to actually carry out the arrest. And not surprisingly, that raises many obstacles. From the kinds of obstacles we're seeing today in Sudan, where the Sudanese government in Khartoum adamantly refuses to arrest Ahmed Haroun and a Janjaweed militia leader charged by the International Criminal Court. You've got out-and-out flouting of the International Criminal Court's arrest warrant, as well as UN Security Council Resolution 1593, which mandated the prosecutor of the court to investigate and try cases arising out of crimes in Darfur, and obligated the Sudanese government to cooperate with those investigations. The Sudanese government is stonewalling and obstructing justice. So you've got that kind of scenario. You mentioned Joseph Kony. I certainly think the government in Uganda, the government of the Congo, where Kony has been holed up for some time, would like to arrest Mr. Kony and surrender him for trial. They lack the capacity to do it, and clearly, as was the case in Bosnia, in arrests that were made for or of Bosnian Serb indictees for the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal, international efforts in conjunction with Ugandan and Democratic Republic of Congo efforts will be needed. In particular, the UN, through its peacekeeping force in the Congo, has a certain role to play, and other state actors who are supportive of bringing peace to the area that Joseph Kony has terrorized, I believe, will have to lend a hand as well. So this capacity to arrest is a real problem for this court, and what often happens is states lack the political will to mobilize themselves to carry out these arrests, and the blame falls on the court as being ineffective, whereas the court never had the capacity to carry out these arrests in the first place. And I think the responsibility and the burden needs to rest on states and the United Nations to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Also, you know, it seems that one recurring, I don't want to say objection, but sort of problem about the court raised, and it's been raised among others, I recall, in an op-ed, you know, maybe a year or two ago by Michael Gerson, a former White House speechwriter, who said that, you know, ICC investigations and ICC indictments are actually impediments to peace in places like, you know, the Sudan. It was used as an excuse to stall Sudanese cooperation with deploying a UN force there. Right. It's also used, you know, for a while in northern Uganda as sort of an excuse for why Kony is staying in the bush and is afraid of coming out and signing a peace accord.
Right.
I was wondering, from your perspective, are those legitimate concerns?
Well, some are and some are not. I think at best, this is conventional wisdom getting circulated and recirculated like air on a jetliner going across the Atlantic. What I mean by that is this is conventional wisdom that does not hold up to close scrutiny. Let's take Uganda. I think as much as we heard from elements of the community in northern Uganda at first that, oh my gosh, the ICC warrants were an obstacle to peace, I think clearly, in retrospect, and I think we saw it at the time, the warrants brought by the International Criminal Court were one important factor that contributed to the isolation of Kony and the LRA that helped compel them to the bargaining table in Juba in July 2006. I'm not saying the arrest warrants were the sole factor or even the principal factor. I think the comprehensive peace accord worked out between northern and southern Sudan that eliminated the base of operations the LRA enjoyed for a number of years was probably the single most factor, but the most important factor. But certainly, the ICC warrants contributed to the LRA's sense of isolation and narrowing of options and were instrumental in bringing about the LRA's desire to sue for peace. Now, that was in 2006. Since the Juba talks, sadly, have fallen apart, what are the lessons we can learn about the argument that we heard again and again, oh, the ICC is the obstacle? I beg to differ. The obstacle to peace was not the ICC, but Joseph Kony and the leadership of the Lord's Resistance Army that has demonstrated its lack, complete lack, of commitment to ending that horrific conflict. One, because Kony failed to show up to sign the final peace agreement, and two, because even as those negotiations were nearing their end, Kony's forces were conducting operations in Central African Republic and Democratic Republic of the Congo, abducting hundreds of children into the LRA forces, hardly an indication or a good faith indication of a commitment to peace. I think, frankly, Kony used the ICC as a scapegoat and a dodge for what was his real agenda, and that was a complete desire for no responsibility from any court whatsoever, plus a big mansion, a lot of money and payoffs from the Ugandan government. Those were the obstacles to peace, not the ICC. And I think looking back on what happened at the Juba talks, intellectual honesty requires, and I think reasonable assessment requires, the conclusion that Kony was shamming and the mouthpieces for Kony were shamming in blaming the ICC. Kony did not want a trial for the acts he is allegedly responsible for in any forum. He wanted a get-out-of-jail free card, and the bad news is, Buster, that in the beginning of the 21st century, there is no more impunity for a 20-year record of child rape, abduction, murder, torture, etc. I think that's what the record of Uganda shows. So let's get over this canard that it was the ICC that blocked the peace talks. It was Joseph Kony and whatever drives that twisted mindset of his?
You know, maybe stepping back for a second, I'd be curious to see sort of your thoughts on how the relationship between the U.S. and the ICC has sort of evolved since the beginning of the Bush administration. Now, maybe to set this up, in the waning weeks of the Clinton administration, the president signed the Rome Statute, but it was never ratified by the Senate. The Rome Statute is what created the International Criminal Court. And then in sort of an early act of the Bush presidency, and in fact this was what John Bolton calls his happiest moment of government service, was to remove the United States' name from the Rome Statute. And that then followed a period of pretty hostile relationships between the two, between the U.S. and the ICC, and I'm wondering sort of how that relationship, in your opinion, has evolved since then.
Well, these are interesting questions, and I will address them as best I can. But I just wanted to add one other point to my comments in regard to peace and justice.
Sure, yeah.
If I may, and that is,
I
think the International Criminal Court is going to be a lightning rod from the diplomatic community, and we're already seeing this in some segments of the United Nations Secretariat. It's going to be a lightning rod for criticism and opposition because unlike the Yugoslav Tribunal, unlike the Rwanda Tribunal, it has a mandate to investigate ongoing conflict situations where UN negotiators and other diplomats are trying to bring about a much-needed peace settlement. And it's for that reason that the ICC is going to encounter, I think, some hostility and frosty reaction from diplomats whose job it is to negotiate peace agreements. Frankly, the existence of the ICC as they themselves, that is, these negotiators at the UN Secretariat will let you know, makes their job more difficult. Well, it makes it more difficult because the ICC is investigating crimes committed in ongoing conflicts. I think that's true. But I think it's a good thing because what it reflects is the international community's desire to end the kind of impunity associated with mass slaughter that was so prevalent in the last decades of the 20th century. So the job of diplomats has become more difficult because international law and the commitment of the international community to bring redress and justice to victims has increased as well. And I think the task for diplomats is to manage the interface between peace and justice in a way that yields both peace agreements without sacrificing justice in the form of amnesty or impunity deals. It's doable. I think we've seen lots of positive examples about it, but that's why the ICC, as I said, is going to attract a certain kind of criticism or frostiness from those who are mandated to negotiate. Our point is, and I think there's ample experience to show this, that justice is a crucial component of a durable peace. So for those tasked to negotiate peace agreements, I think it would be short-lived to think, or short-sighted, to think that peace could be pursued at the exclusion of justice. Diplomats need to find a way to broaden their skills in making sure that justice is either part of a peace deal or not preempted or otherwise excluded from a peace negotiation.
Maybe we could go back to the question a second and follow this thread that you started here, but we'll get back to the U.S. objections.
Yeah, okay.
I just want to follow up on that because, you know, it seems to me at least that another Maybe this is sort of the political step above sort of the actual sort of secretary and negotiators, but one sort of political problem or dilemma facing the ICC is the fact that so there are four cases right now. They're all pretty much in the same region of sub-Saharan Africa. It seems to me that one criticism of the ICC is that it's this kind of European created, this Western institution imposing justice on Africa, and that there is sort of that sort of it's almost a sort of Western countries aren't coming under ICC investigation and ICC indictment. Really, it's sort of an international tool to prosecute Africans, and I imagine that this is sort of a problem. I think that sort of that diplomats have encountered when sort of facing these investigations.
Well, these are important questions, and let me answer it in three parts. One, this was not a court created by Western powers to prosecute Africans. I attended a meeting in Pretoria, South Africa, in September 1997 with representatives from foreign ministries and justice ministries of the 14 states at that time of the Southern African Development Community that came together in a three-day conference and formulated the 10 principles of the Southern African Development Community for an effective and fair international criminal court. Those principles became an important part of the negotiating dynamic. My point being, officials from Africa were deeply involved in the negotiation process to create this court, as were officials from many Latin American states. The Rome negotiation included lawyers from approximately 150 governments, and at the end of the conference, 120 of those governments voted in favor of the adoption of the treaty. So I think it's wildly inaccurate to make this or allege that this is a court created by the West. In fact, as you indicated in an earlier question, the principal obstacle and opponent of this court for a number of years, from 2002 to 2005, when the court was just coming into being, was the government of the United States, hardly making the ICC a tool of the West in pursuit of Africans. The facts just don't support that interpretation. Second point is, yes, you're right, the four active investigations going on today are in Africa. I think that's a reflection, you know, unfortunately, of the horrific crimes that have occurred in parts of Africa, and the fact that in three of those four situations, Sudan being the exception, the governments of Central African Republic, Uganda, and Democratic Republic of the Congo have invited the International Criminal Court in to do its investigation. So it's not as if the ICC intruded. They were invited by the government, which I think is testament to the legitimacy of the court. Thirdly, I think it's a sad reality, and one we have to acknowledge and work to change, and that is the playing field of international justice is uneven. You're exactly right, and I think it's sad and dismaying that you won't find governmental leaders from the United States or from the Russian Federation charged by the International Criminal Court for crimes they may have committed either in Iraq or Afghanistan or in Chechnya. And that reflects the fact that international justice is one relatively new and relatively fragile, and the great powers have insulated themselves in various ways. I think that is something groups like Human Rights Watch are committed to doing everything we can to change so that governments are not protected from investigation and prosecution simply because they are located in powerful states. But that is a reality. We are working to change that. It will take some time to bring that change about. And lastly, on this note, I think it's imperative that the ICC prosecutor use the authority that he has to open investigations on his own authority. That is a power vested in him by the Rome Statute. He could, if he chose, to investigate in Colombia, in Afghanistan, in countries that are not located in Africa. The prosecutor is conducting analysis of crimes in those countries. To his credit, he has spoken out publicly about his analysis of crimes in Colombia and Afghanistan. And I think it is incumbent on the prosecutor to use that power he has to open up an investigation in a country where significant crimes have occurred, where the government has not invited him in, as the African governments have, and begin work there.
Mm-hmm. I guess this maybe raises the question of how much discretion the prosecutor has. You know, I'm personally a fan of the current prosecutor, Moreno Ocampo. And you know, I talk to people who are skeptical or opposed or just generally hostile to the ICC. And one of their principal objections is that, okay, this prosecutor might be good, but what if the next prosecutor decides to, you know, start investigating, you know, Rumsfeld or Bush for crimes committed in Iraq or while they're in office? And this, yeah, you know, to me seems like, you know, it seems that there is a chance of these sort of what the opponents would call politically motivated prosecutions in the future, and I'm wondering how would you respond to that?
Well, first let me say, I think Moreno Ocampo has an incredibly difficult job. I think the challenges and obstacles that face the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court are, hard to even quantify. I mean, you mentioned before, we talked a little bit about the reliance, dependence of the court, of the prosecutor, on cooperation by states to arrest individuals. This prosecutor's job is incredibly difficult to do, and I think any assessment of his work or the work of the court as a whole has got to be set in that objective context in terms of the enormous challenges. The U.S. attorney in Manhattan for the Southern District of New York has a much easier job than Moreno Ocampo. The U.S. attorney has police, has agencies to carry out his arrest warrants, etc. Moreno Ocampo has none of that. So it is an exceedingly difficult job that he has to do. I think in terms of the concern, we as a human rights organization, an organization committed to fair trials for any accused, regardless of what crimes they are charged with, we don't want to see the International Criminal Court instrumentalized as a vehicle to advance any political agenda. We think that would be a degradation of the judicial function and ultimately the legitimacy and credibility of this institution. So we don't take second place to anyone concerned that the court might or could become a vehicle for politically motivated prosecutions.
Can I ask for a second? Are there within the court structures or institutions that might sort of counterbalance or check a sort of politically motivated prosecutor? from launching investigations?
Yes, there are, and I think that is really the response, or that is the reality that I would point to for those who fear the prospect of the court being instrumentalized for political objectives. Now,
be specific? What sort of checks and balances, I guess, are there?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, the ICC is a court of last resort, which means it only takes a role when and where the national courts that should be investigating and prosecuting these kinds of crimes are either unable or unwilling to do so. So the ICC, if you will, defers to the national authorities to do the work the national judicial system should be doing. It's involved in the Congo because the president of the Congo requested the ICC, citing that his government and his courts were unable to do the job in bringing to justice those most responsible for serious acts of slaughter of civilians and use of rape as a weapon of terror. So the first defense is that if the national authorities do what they should do, then there is no cause for the ICC to get involved. And there are strict standards set out in the ICC treaty that help give a sense, and it's a high threshold for the prosecutor to make the case that he has a role to play rather than the national authorities in any investigation. One would hope U.S. authorities would do what they should do and investigate serious and substantive allegations of criminal conduct by any U.S. Military or civilian official. If that were done, that would preempt any ICC activity whatsoever. There is the ability of individuals and governments to challenge before judges of the court the decision by the prosecutor to undertake an investigation in that particular country. In other words, the prosecutor of the court, his decision in going for an investigation is subject to judicial review by the judges who get to hear challenges coming from individuals and governments as to the appropriateness or legitimacy of that decision by the prosecutor. Similarly, there could be no investigation of Donald Rumsfeld by the International Criminal Court for the simple reason that the ICC, or I should say the U.S. government, is not a party to the Rome Treaty of the ICC, and that is a requirement for the court to be able to carry out its investigation and prosecution. Let me just add to that in the interest of completeness. Let's take Iraq. If the government of Iraq was a party to the ICC treaty, and it is not, and there were allegations of crimes committed by U.S. forces in Iraq that could be linked to Donald Rumsfeld, there wouldn't be a basis for the prosecutor to investigate because either Iraq or the United States would have to belong to the court to create the necessary, if you will, jurisdictional conditions for an ICC investigation. So there are limitations on the authority of the prosecutor.
I guess if the ICC is unable to, say, investigate an American because the United States is not party to the ICC, is that not sort of an argument against the United States joining the ICC. I mean, why should the U.S. sort of, you know, reverse course and join the ICC if there is the chance that Americans might be prosecuted before the court?
Well, last time I checked, the U.S. government upholds a commitment to the rule of law and justice. While it waterboards detainees in various holding facilities around the world, it nonetheless, at least in terms of its rhetoric, maintains a commitment to the rule of law and adherence to international treaties. And I think it's very much in the U.S. government's self-interest, not to mention the interest of the American people, to see that these kinds of crimes are prosecuted wherever they occur and by whomever is alleged to be responsible. If we let that go, if the United States were to let that go, I think any claim to be a rule of law supporting nation, any claim to back and support international human rights would go down the drain. I would hope that the United States government, less so in this administration, more so in future administrations, would adhere to the rule of law, and in that context would carry out legitimate investigations of anyone, civilian or military, for whom there is credible basis to believe may be implicated in widespread or systematic crimes, crimes of torture, murder, etc., committed as part of a plan or policy. I think that is a fundamental commitment of the United States, and while I acknowledge and mourn the fact that this government has strayed from that, in particular over the last several years, one hopes that's a temporary aberration. And if it is a temporary aberration, the U.S. government and certainly the American people would have every interest in seeing the United States investigate and prosecute its own, and if it failed to do so, then have as a backstop an international mechanism, that is the ICC, founded on principles of due process and respect for the rights of the accused, step in and fill the vacuum where the United States, sadly, for one reason or another, dropped the ball. I think that's consistent with the most deeply held American values, that is, accountability for alleged crimes under law.
I agree that it would be sort of consistent with American values. I just worry sort of what would happen to the court if an American were ever sort of brought before it. I feel like that, you know, as you said, you know, as for a great power, if an American were brought before the court, one might imagine that the United States would use its influence to, you know, undermine the court as much as it could, maybe sort of, you know, lean on its European allies to revoke court funding. You know, it seems that sort of the day that the ICC decides to target an American is really like the day the ICC ceases to function as I think it should and it can, in the sense that it's such a far-fetched, first of all, it's really, I think, a very far-fetched and improbable that the ICC would ever investigate an American. You know, precisely, I think, for the reasons you outlined earlier, that we do have a functioning judiciary here. You know, and it seems to me that when the ICC does investigate an American, it will sort of be a hard day for the ICC to function thereafter, although maybe it might be seen as more legitimate in sort of international eyes. Maybe I want to maybe...
Could I, just, Mark, just if, sort I, of, if I could just yeah, take yeah, a quick thought on that.
Please, one please. Is, yeah. Yeah, please.
One is that, frankly, you know, the Bush administration, I think to its shame, from 2002 to 2005, conducted what, you know, I think can only be called a jihad against the ICC. You referred earlier to former Ambassador Bolton's self-described happiest day in public service, the day he thought that he erased the U.S. signature on the ICC treaty. And from that moment on, for 3 years, the U.S. tried nearly everything to undermine the court, blackmailing governments, extremely vulnerable governments around the world, to violate their obligations as treaty members to the ICC. As far as I'm aware, it was the first time in U.S. diplomatic history where an American government sanctioned other states for supporting the rule of law as opposed to undermining the rule of law. I mean, this was a dark, shameful moment in U.S. diplomatic history. I think Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in 2006 acknowledged that, you know, in a public comment she made when she said our very active ICC policy, I mean, with that we essentially were shooting ourselves in the foot. And indeed they did shoot themselves in the foot. And I would say, frankly, they shot themselves a little higher up in their anatomies, which was the fact that fortunately, I think, persuaded this administration to back away from its highly ideological opposition to the court, an opposition that was led by the likes of John Bolton and Vice President Cheney and former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and take a somewhat more pragmatic approach. I welcome that and think that it's a positive development without overstating it. But that's you know, that's an evolution that's worth taking note of. And you know, my last point on this issue is that you began by asking about politically motivated prosecutions. And I think if there were a politically motivated prosecution of an American or a Brazilian or a Botswanan, that should be opposed because it degrades the court's judicial function. And I can assure you, if there was a politically motivated prosecution, Human Rights Watch and other human rights organizations committed to both justice and the court would make their voices heard about that. But my assumption is that any prosecution the ICC would bring would be based in fact and law, not politically motivated. And then I think the United States government, or I hope the United States government, would look at that more carefully than the Bush administration did when there were no prosecutions back in 2002. And certainly we've seen the European governments and governments from around the world withstand very fierce U.S. government pressure against the court in its earliest days. And I would hope that that support would continue. So from whatever opposition or pressure the U.S. brought to bear politically, it would not break the ICC, so long, again, as that prosecution was based in fact and law.
Do you have time for one last question?
Sure.
If not, that's okay.
No, let's do it.
I just wanted to maybe ask you, sort of going forward in sort of looking at sort of the next election, at how you see U.S.-ICC relations evolving, if sort of under the presidency of any one of the three sort of remaining candidates.
Well, I think, Mark, the U.S.-ICC relationship has evolved positively over the last few years. And I, you know, again, in fairness, I want to credit more pragmatic minds in the Bush administration for taking, for abandoning the ferocious ideological antipathy exhibited by John Bolton, a policy that brought the U.S. nothing but discredit and grief. And it's not just Human Rights Watch saying that. You talk to senior uniformed military personnel who are based in Latin America, and they will tell you how the sanctions that former U.S. Representative Tom DeLay, no longer a member of the U.S. Congress, of course, pushed through the Congress on governments that supported the ICC, how much those sanctions harmed U.S. military interests in Latin America for a reality check on the Bolton ideologically motivated opposition to the ICC. And
if I could interrupt you for a second, I think one of my favorite examples or the of this is the fact that for 4 months the Latvian army, there was a Latvian contingent and the Coalition of the Willing in Iraq. Latvia had not sort of signed what you're referring to, an Article 98 agreement granting U.S. soldiers immunity on Latvian soil. And as such, they were sort of denied military aid. So you had this weird situation for a while where Latvian soldiers were serving side-by-side American soldiers in Iraq, but yet the Latvian military was sort of denied for a military aid package for having refused to sign this immunity agreement.
Well, yeah.
So
that's exactly right.
So it led to these very awkward situations.
Right. And
we've evolved since then, as you were saying.
And I would ask Ambassador Bolton, you know, to address what General Nathaniel Jones said about the effect in Kenya. Let's remember that in August 1998, the United States Embassy in Nairobi was bombed by Al-Qaeda activists. A number of Kenyans and U.S. State Department employees were killed as a result. Due to the Bolton Tom DeLay policy on the ICC, Kenya lost military assistance from the United States because it refused to sign one of these unlawful contracts that at that point Washington was insisting on. What that meant was an important front in the Bush administration's war against terror was weakened because of ideological opposition due to a court that offended the likes and dislikes of extreme ideologues who happened to be in the U.S. government. General Nathaniel Jones spoke to those concerns and the detriment to U.S. military and security policy in that important part of the world. I think John Bolton and that crew needs to address that reality as part of its anti-ICC explanation and a bit of accountability for a reckless and irresponsible policy that they pursued when they were in government. Looking forward, I think there is positive momentum to build on for the next administration, whichever party is in the White House. And this flows from the evolution of the last few years, where we have seen greater willingness on the part of the U.S. government to cooperate with the International Criminal Court, where clearly the International Criminal Court's work was consistent with and advancing certain U.S. policy objectives against the Lord's Resistance Army in northern Uganda, against horrific crimes committed on people in Darfur, and against individuals in the government of Sudan. So we've seen, I wouldn't say a warm and fuzzy relationship evolve, but a more pragmatic and cooperative one. I think what has to happen in the next administration is the United States government needs to, one, participate as an observer, as it is entitled to do, in various ICC meetings. There are a number of governments that are not party to the Rome Statute, but do participate as observers. Sadly and foolishly, the Bush administration has declined to take advantage of that opportunity. I think whether it's a McCain administration, a Clinton administration, or an Obama administration, they need to reverse that. I think there needs to be a further narrowing and ultimately a repeal of the legislative sanctions that the Tom DeLay Congress put in place against the ICC that eliminated both military and economic assistance to a number of very vulnerable ICC states. That needs to be repealed, and I think the United States government needs to find ways to work more closely with the court in carrying out its investigations. Ultimately, the United States needs to join the ICC as a state party. But I recall the fact that it took the U.S. Senate 40 years to ratify the Convention to Prevent and Punish Genocide. It took the United States Senate 25 years to ratify the International Magna Carta of Human Rights, that is, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So our Senate doesn't have a track record as a speedy actor in ratifying important international agreements. Eventually it will happen. I think sooner rather than later would be preferable. I'm confident it will, but realistically, I think that's a little ways down the road yet.
Well, thank you so much, Richard. This was a really great chat. I appreciate it. This was great. I appreciate you speaking to us, and I've learned a lot. So thank you.
Well, my pleasure.
And so I'm going to stop the capture right now.